fill to capacity, where heart, grit, and irreverent humor collide. A podcast for people too stubborn to quit and too creative not to make a difference. Hi, I'm Pat Benincasa, and welcome to Fill to Capacity. Today's episode, Calm in a Crisis, First of the First Responders. My guest is Marlis X. Marlis is a 911 dispatcher, and she has asked me not to use her last name because 911 dispatchers are sometimes subject to death threats. So a little background about what they do. In the United States, there are about 95,000 police, fire, and ambulance dispatchers. And that's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They handle, are you ready for this? They handle around 240 million calls in the U.S. every year. 77.8% of all 911 dispatchers are women. So, working at a public safety answering point, a PSAP, can be very difficult. 911 dispatchers have to remain calm when taking a call. They are listening to someone else's absolute worst day, and they are the first responders. And just so you know, folks, dispatchers have to juggle situation assessment and collect the caller address, give it to police, fire, or EMTs, but first responders rely on them to ensure their safety. With all that said, welcome, Marlis. So nice to have you here.
Thank you. And nice to be here as well. And I have to confess, I am not used to being face-to-face with anybody I'm talking to. So this is a little strange for me. I wear a headset and I'm looking at computer monitors, not another face.
That's right.
Not yet.
Okay. Okay, listeners. Now you heard that caveat. We are doing a Zoom pre-record and we can see each other, but this will be an audio podcast. So we're just going to jump right in. Marlis, what do you do as a dispatcher, and what does a typical day look like for you?
What I do as a dispatcher is I do multiple jobs. A lot of PSAPs or primary service answering points. Sometimes it's just one person. Sometimes it's hundreds. It really depends on the jurisdiction that they're in. So if it's just like one or five people, they're answering the phones and talking on the radio at the exact same time. Whereas in my PSAP, we have call takers who are not talking on the radio. We have others that are dispatchers that are talking on the radio to the various responders out there. And we also have another desk that we call data. And they do a completely different set of things. They talk on both phone and the radio somewhat simultaneously. So it all depends on what my assignment for that day is. Generally speaking, I'm doing half call taking, half dispatching, or half call taking, half data. Sometimes it's all one. Sometimes it's all the other. It just kind of depends. And in our PSAP, we also take non-emergency calls. So I never, ever know what's coming in next. It could be a parking complaint. It could be a vehicle that's been overturned and caught on fire with people trapped inside. And the next call could be somebody's dog is barking down the road and it's driving them crazy. And then the next call could be an airplane crashing at our local airport, or you just never know.
So describe your physical work area. Like, do you have TV monitors, radio equipment, phones, computer screens? What does your world look like when you go to work?
Well, I can show you. And so we're going to gauge Pat's reaction based on this photo that comes up.
Whoa. Okay, listeners, you are not going to believe what I'm looking at. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 monitors, and on top of that, there's a huge monitor. And this is your work area?
All of our desks pretty much look like this. So we have 6 to 8 monitors, depending on what desk we're sitting at. Typically, there's 6 or 7. This is like a semicircular desk. It's divided in half, front and back, so that we can raise and lower the front and the back of the desk according to what we need. We can stand, we can sit, we can adjust them to make it comfortable for us.
Okay.
And then what you also can't see, listeners, is that there are 2 keyboards, there are 4 mice, there's a separate keypad for the phone. Underneath the desk, there are foot pedals for controlling the radio. And coming off the left side of the desk, curly Q cord coming off that is plugged into the desk and goes to my headset. Plus, there's 2 lights up above. And then in front of the keyboard that's half hidden by my multiple drink glasses up there are 4 speakers as well. So if I do happen to be talking on the phone and the radio at the same time, which can happen, if I'm on the phone, the radio sound is going to come out of the speakers in front of my face. So I listen to the phone with one ear and I listen to the speakers with my other ear. And I listen to the room in general with my open ear as well. So we're always, always listening. But yeah, we're always looking at all of these monitors.
Hey, listeners, I will include this image in the show notes.
Usually when people walk in, they say, it looks like you're driving a spaceship. And that's probably pretty accurate.
Yes, this looks like something I would see out of NASA.
Yeah. Well, if we are taking a phone call, that's the monitor on the left. If we're taking a phone call in, and the next monitor you see over is the map. So we're looking at a map to see where they're located based on what the person's phone is telling us.
Okay.
Sorry, everybody. Hollywood thinks that we can just go find you. That doesn't happen like that. Your phone tells us where you're at, if you have a good phone. And so we're looking at that to see where you're mapping. And that's always an approximate location. It's not always accurate. And then the next couple monitors are where I'm putting in the phone call. And I'm looking at other calls that might be nearby that might be related or not related.
Okay.
I'm looking at the units and so forth. And then I have 2 monitors over on the right-hand side that are giving me audio from 2 different radio systems. And I have another monitor there where I can access records. I can access the internet. I can access my email. And I'm literally using all of those computer monitors at the same time, depending on what information I need. My eyes are constantly moving.
Okay. Wow. That was really good. Thank you. What kind of training does a person have to go through to become a dispatcher?
It's really, honestly, independent of each PSAP. So let's talk about the state of Florida. First of all, they have a state mandated academy that all dispatchers have to go through. And they have a certain number of classes, radio, records, you name it, call taking, everything. Other states, it's the first day you start, you sit down with a person that's been there for a while and you're listening for a little bit, but eventually you start talking really quick. Other places, it's a little bit longer. So, for instance, with my agency, you are in an academy for about a month, maybe 5 weeks, give or take. And in there, you go through all the medical protocols and you get certified in that. You go through all the fire protocols and get certified in that. You go through police call taking and you get certified in that. And then you go through the data certification, which is running plates and people, putting in missing or stolen items, everything from a car to a cat. Yes, we can list cats or animals as missing or stolen, to a trombone, to taking missing people back out or submitting stuff through what's called a triple I or through the FBI. Or we can even send stuff, if we have to, through Interpol, which is really weird. That's part of the triple I system. And you know, so many other things. So you get certified in that as well. We also do practice call taking on a training system with the CAD or computer-aided dispatch. So you're learning how to use that. On top of that, you're learning how to use the phone because there's so many things on there. And that's all just in the academy. And then you come to the live communications floor with a certified training officer or CTO. We use a lot of acronyms.
Yeah.
So, a lot of acronyms. So you come to the floor with a CTO like myself, and you just start taking live calls. Now, the first few calls you take, you kind of feel like a puppet because I'm saying, as a CTO, I'm saying, say this, do this, click that, push that button over there. So you feel a little bit like a puppet, but after about 6 to 12 weeks, it depends. Some people take a little longer, some people don't take as long, but the average is about 6 to 8 weeks. And after that, you go through stages of the call taking training, and eventually you're signed off. And for the next 2 weeks after that, you are what we call not in the count, meaning you're taking live calls, but you're not considered part of the seating schedule or how many minimum, maximum people we're supposed to have on the floor. And that's just to kind of give you a time to breathe, be a part of the floor before you start getting ordered for overtime or being part of the seating count and expected to be at a certain spot or whatever. Based on averages, we know how many people we need minimum to be on the floor at any certain time of the day or night and any day of the week. So most people find fascinating is that Tuesday is typically our busiest day.
Tuesday?
Tuesday. Yeah, because well, people, I mean, weekends can be busy, but Monday everybody's recovering and getting back into work. Tuesday is when they start calling again. That's kind of the way we think of it. And we know that during from 6:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. on a Tuesday, we should probably have 15 people there. And on Monday, we should have maybe 14, 13 or 14. You know, it just kind of depends. We do staff up for different things. So we are a unified dispatch center, meaning we dispatch for all of the agencies within our county, or a combined dispatch center. Depends on where you're from. We either say unified or combined. We have over 20 police departments, over 20 fire departments, and I think it's like 18 EMS departments, something like that. I take phone calls for and dispatch for. We also coordinate with what we call outside agencies, such as the electrical company or the water companies or streets and lights, or the we also have two interstates going through our county, so we coordinate with the state patrol. We have the state capitol in our jurisdiction, so we deal with the Capitol Police, and we have a major university in our jurisdiction, so they have their own police department, and we take calls for all of them. And if we have a dignitary coming in, such as, you know, Vice President Kamala Harris, who gave us short notice one day that she was arriving. Typically, it's several days' notice. So we've had the President of the United States, or the Vice President of the United States. We've had the Dalai Lama, of course, concerts, those types of dignitaries or other dignitaries that come in. We're always involved in that. And I think people are amazed to hear that. Like, why do you need to be involved in the President of the United States coming in to visit your city? Okay, yeah, the president has the Secret Service and all the other people that follow the president around. You know, the people have people. So you think they'd be able to coordinate all that at the same time? But the Secret Service doesn't know our jurisdiction. We know our jurisdiction. They don't dispatch our police officers for the motorcade. They don't pre-plan two ambulances or three ambulances, however many the Secret Service tells they want as a backup. Because whenever a dignitary is in town, an ambulance has to follow them around. At least one. Clearing roads, blocking roads, that all has to come in through us. That means we also have to notify the metro busing department. We have to notify the taxi companies. These roads are blocked for this, that, or the other thing. We deal with the public calling in saying, "Why are the roads blocked? I can't get through to my work." Well, you're going to have to go around. "I don't like going that way." Well, I'm sorry. So we deal with all of that.
I got to stop you here because
Yeah.
after that litany of all of these departments, people,
Yeah.
public, personalities, politicians, I got to ask you, what makes a good dispatcher?
What makes a good dispatcher is somebody who has an enormous amount of patience, the ability to be what we call the calm in the storm. You have to just understand that you can only do one thing at a time. Okay, well, we do 16 things at a time,
Yeah, I was
but
just going to say,
I can
you just told us, Marlis, that you do 5, 10, 15 things at one time.
but it's only for one person at a time. Do you
Okay.
understand that?
Yeah,
So, yeah,
okay.
if okay, I'm dealing with 16, 17, 23 different things for one call. So it's one call at a time, but it may involve many others, the coordination of those or working with those. to get things done, even tow companies. I mean, we work with everybody. We communicate with them all the time. You just have to be able to multitask really, really well. That's part of the testing process that happens before you even get hired, is can you multitask? And there's testing for that. And because the way we train, we start with one thing, and then we add it, and then we add another, and we add another, and we add another. And pretty soon, even through the academy and through live call taking with a CTO, you learn to multitask by default because we layer it on in such a way that it just becomes second nature.
So I have to ask you, you get a call that's really life or death, and you're responding to it. What do you do to keep your calm? I mean, some of these calls must scare the living daylights out of you in terms of life or death issue. How do you
Oh,
remain
absolutely.
calm?
You have to. The one thing you have to remember, I mean, on the inside, sometimes we're screaming or yelling right along with our callers. Sometimes you're crying with them, like tears are running down your face. They can be really heart-wrenching or terrifying, but you have to be the calm for them. They are having the absolute worst moment of their life, and everybody's perception of an emergency is different. You can't judge a person just because it's not an emergency to you doesn't mean it's not an emergency to them. So I'm going to treat everybody with the same level of calm because I need to be that calm because they can't at that moment. And knowing that I have so many tasks to do also keeps me grounded. I have to do this, I have to do that, I have to click here, I have to go over here, I have to do this, I have to say this, I have to write this. And all the time, I'm getting information from them, and I'm doing what we call our line of questioning, which any dispatcher is going to know what that means. It's basically a, I wouldn't say scripted questions, but a line of questions that we use depending on the situation. It just depends, what's going on. But you just got to be calm. And sometimes that's what that person needs. It doesn't matter how many names they're calling you, it doesn't matter how much they're screaming. It doesn't matter how much they're saying, just get the cops here. Like, if I could push a button and Star Trek them there, I would. I can't. We aren't at that level of technology yet. They got to drive there, but we get it. 1 minute to you and me is nothing, but when your brain is in full emergency mode, 1 minute feels like 10 hours.
Oh, absolutely. That
So
brings me to my next question. How on earth do you balance the need for quick decision making with the pressure to get all the details right?
Fill to Capacity is brought to you by one of the most celebrated persons in history, Joan of Arc. How about carrying a bit of Joan's courage with you all the time? You can with the Joan of Arc Scroll Medal designed by award-winning artist Pat Benincasa. With loving attention to detail, Joan has banner in hand and is charging off the scroll-shaped medal with the words, "Be at my side." This beautiful brass alloy medal is ideal for holiday or special occasion gifts. Don't wait. Capture a bit of history and inspiration today. Visit www.patbenincasa-art.com. Now, back to the podcast.
How do I answer that one? That is a tough one. I think it comes down to the training. It really is the training, and also knowing you cannot know everything. It's not possible. I've been doing this for over 14 years. Every day I'm learning something new, and I have to rely on my teammates. My teammates, remember, I have a headset. It's just one ear that my headset is covering one ear, and my other ear is open to the room, to radios, multiple radios in the room, to people talking on the phones, to other coworkers asking me questions about maybe the call that I'm on or the officers that I'm dispatching, if I happen to be dispatching at that point. I'm always listening with two ears to multiple conversations. And I have to rely on my teammates in order to balance all of that together to get all the information that's needed. I may be taking this caller that is ramped up to the point of no return. And all I need to know is the shirt color of the person that just assaulted them. And they're just bl literally blithering. And I have the dispatcher saying, I need a shirt color. I need a shirt color. The cops are rolling up. Who's the suspect? Who's the victim? And I'm trying. I'm really trying to get that information, but they are completely hysterical. And the caller can hear me say that, which can often either really piss them off, or it takes them out of that blithering state into some comprehension. You know, and we use what we call repetitive persistence. So, Pat, if you're all wound up about something, just got assaulted by this person you didn't even know. They like come into your yard as you're mowing your grass and they decide to beat you with a baseball bat and take off running. Like, and yes, that does happen. Random stuff like that happens. And you are completely hysterical. You're in a lot of pain. You don't know what the just happened. And I'm like, Pat, I need you to listen to me. Take a breath. Do you remember what color shirt they're wearing? Blather, blah, blah. Pat, I need you to listen to me. I need you to take a deep breath. Do you remember what color shirt they're wearing? Pat, I need you to take a deep breath. I want you to
Yeah.
listen to me. Do you remember what color shirt they're wearing? And you notice that my voice gets lower and lower and lower and lower. And what happens is I can get all the way down to a whisper. And what it does is it forces the other person's brain to just shut up and listen, because now the brain's like, wait, 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 wait. What's going on? I didn't quite catch that. And it switches. So we learn a lot of psychology, I guess,
Yeah.
you know, in our training and in our classes. And that really helps as well. And, you know, I'm talking, I'm typing at the same time, and we use what we call dispatcher speak in our notes. So a lot of people think we write these books. We don't. Pat, if you're in a car accident and you say, well, I say, tell me exactly what happened. Well, I was driving down the interstate. It's a beautiful day out here. And I'm like, oh, just tell me what happened. Yeah, that's what's going through my head. Just tell me what happened. Yeah, I'm driving down the interstate and the semi comes blowing by me really fast and it rocks my car. And the next thing I know, something flies off of the truck and it hits my car, and your brain realizes what just happened. And I'm like, what happened? Whatever it was that hit my car, it came clear through my windshield and it hit me in the face and there's blood everywhere and I think I wrecked my car. Well, I just got that whole story, right?
Yeah.
What I type in the notes is, now I know there's a car crash with injuries, right? I'm starting EMS. I'm starting my medical protocols. It's a couple of clicks. I start the medical protocols. And over here, I'm like, okay, Pat, I want you to take a big deep breath for me. I understand you've just been in a car crash and something came through your window. And in my medical protocols, I type single car crash, something came through the window, blood everywhere. That's all I've typed. I didn't need to type. She was driving down the interstate. It's a beautiful day. Whatever the unimportant information, right?
Yeah.
It may be important later in the call, so I have to keep that in my head. What I tell my trainees is that parking lot, park it in a spot. You may need it later, but right now it's not needed. And it's learning to separate all of that. And I'll come back. I'll go through my medical protocols, and I'll be like, "Okay, Pat, I'm still with you. I'm still with you." I've got the ambulance coming your direction. I've got a fire truck coming your way. I've even got police officers because it's a car crash, right? I said, now while we're waiting on those to get there, I want you to find a clean, dry cloth or towel. I don't care if it's napkins. I don't care if it's your shirt or jacket. Where are you bleeding from your forehead? You said maybe part of the protocols. We got that. I want you to press that on there and I want you to hold it down firmly and don't lift it up to look. We need to stop that bleeding. Oh, and while you're doing that, do you happen to remember the name of the company that was on that semi that went by you so fast? Now that's come back around, and it's amazing what people's brains pick up that they're not aware of. And they'll be like, well, I don't remember the name, but there was a big red apple on the side of the white trailer, and the truck, I think the truck was blue, and the trailer was white and had the big red apple. Good enough for me. It's amazing. So I got you out of that somewhat confused mode through the panic mode when you realized what happened. So You started here, you went up high, and you came back down low as through my line of questioning with my medical protocols, getting all this other information, giving you safety information. Shut off your car if it's safe to do so. Turn on your flashing hazard lights if it's safe to do so. All that other stuff. And you're listening to me. And it's just all part of the training. And I'm typing in there what's going on, even as I'm doing it, even as I'm asking you. Yeah.
Okay,
Kind of
my
like a court recorder.
yeah,
Court reporter.
that's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
You know, the 14 years that you've been doing this, can you describe a call that just so reminded you why your job is so crucial in spite of the stress and why it's so important that you do it?
So I'm going to use an alias here.
Yes.
I'm just going to call her Angela, not her real name. She's alive and well to this day. And if you met this woman, there's only one word that you're going to be able to use to describe her, and that's the word vibrant. It's impossible to use any other word to describe this woman other than vibrant. And as I've come to know Angela through the years since I initially had contact with her via her son, the first go around, is that she's always been like this. I don't think she knows the meaning of the word slow down unless she's sleeping, to be honest with you. So I get a call, absolute dead panic call from what I learned later was her 17-year-old son. Angela had been out grocery shopping and she was bringing groceries in, and her son, we'll call him Carl, was in the kitchen putting groceries away even as his mom was bringing them in, and they were yakking with each other, and she was standing there telling him something. I don't remember what it was. And Carl's telling me all this information because his 17-year-old brain is completely out of whack. All of a sudden, his mother collapses and starts to shake in front of him. So he calls in, "I think my mom is having a seizure." Well, that was a reasonable assumption. She collapsed, she's shaking. All right. So I started off with our seizure protocol, our seizure medical protocol, got the ambulance rolling, got the officers rolling because they go along with the ambulance and where they live. And all of a sudden, I hear the most alarming noise that anybody can hear, and it's really hard to describe. And so, listeners, any 911 dispatchers know right now, know exactly what I'm talking about. But any common person, if you ever hear something like a snort snore, like a that is called agonal breathing. That person is actually not breathing. It is the person's brain trying to kick the lungs back in and heart back into gear. Her heart had stopped and her brain was trying to fire. Your brain is still alive for quite a while, even as your heart is stuttering. So she was in what's called atrial fibrillation. Her heart was shaking like a bowl of jello. Her lungs weren't working correctly. Her brain was trying to fire that. I heard that noise. I was like, "So, Carl, is that your mom?" He goes, Yeah, she's breathing really funny." I said, "Well, that's not real breathing. We need to do chest compressions on your mom." And he went from hysterical to beyond hysterical. He was already ramped up. 17-year-old brains don't process emergencies well at all. And I actually had to haul out what I call mom voice. I felt really bad afterwards, but I had to do it. He went so far up that I said, "Carl, I need you to shut up, stop, and listen. I need you to take a big deep breath. Because if you pass out, neither you nor I are going to be able to help your mom. Do you understand me?" By that time, I had two coworkers looking at me like, "Geez, lady." I'm like, "Oops." And he's like, Okay. But I don't have a chest compression." Like, he ramped back up again. And I'm like, "Okay, that's what I'm here for, Carl. I will tell you how to do it." And he's like, Okay. And you hear him take a big deep breath. He's like, "Okay, tell me." We did chest compressions on his mother. I should say he did chest compressions on his mom for 6 minutes. The nearest ambulance was already out on another call. The next nearest ambulance was also out on a call. We had to bring one in from further away. 6 minutes he did chest compressions on his mother just to keep her heart going and keep oxygen going back and forth between her brain and her heart, okay, to keep her alive. And the crews got there. Carl backed off quite a bit. He was still pretty ramped up. I kept him on the phone and I just kept telling him, "Hey, Carl, you did a really good job. Thank you for sticking with me. They're going to do everything for your mama that they can. I want you to just keep going, keep breathing. And eventually I hung up. I found out later she got shocked 6 times at the house because she's still in AFib, right? They were not overly successful in getting her intubated. Angela is one of those, a toothpick is probably fat compared to her. So just one of these little tiny people. And they had a really hard time getting the intubation tube down her throat because she's so tiny. And Carl was witnessing all of this, and it was further traumatizing him seeing his mother get shocked, seeing the struggle that they had getting her intubated. She got shocked in the ambulance. She got shocked again when she got to the hospital. They were able to revitalize her. They took her into the cath lab. She never had a heart attack, so she had no blockages in any of her arteries or anything like that. So she didn't have a myocardial infarction or heart attack. She didn't have any electrical issues wrong with her heart either that they could find. So the heart has its own electrical system separate from the brain. They put in a pacemaker and defib just in case because they never did figure out what happened with her heart, but they wanted to make sure if it happened again, there was a device there to kick in faster. So this happened a couple of weeks before Christmas. I got a call on Christmas Eve from my supervisor that said she survived. She's getting to go home today on Christmas Eve. And talk about best Christmas present ever, right? I met her at a survivor's banquet the following February, and I remember her husband grabbing me in a really tight bear hug. And what he says to me is, "Thank you for saving my life." Not my wife. He goes, "Thank you for saving my life. She is my life." And that made me cry. I was already crying. That just tipped me right over the edge into bawling, probably. Now, fast forward a few years. Carl has gone on to university. He has become a doctor, all because of everything that happened with his mother. And to top it all off, he and his good buddy that he became buddies with this person going through medical school. And because of how tiny his mother was and how hard they had a hard time intubating her, they invented and patented a magnetic device that will guide the intubation tube, and the magnet will not interfere with any implanted devices in the person's body. He went and did all this all because of what his mother went through, what he went through, and how I helped him save his mom. This is what we do. So it's kind of a long story, but it took forward over a few years. Now fast forwarded a few more years, and we go to our state senators and representatives to petition that all of my state's telecommunicators or dispatchers must be certified in telephone CPR because every agency kind of has their own policy on that. And not all dispatchers had been trained on how to do CPR over the phone. My agency happens to be very trained. We're what's called an advanced EMDs, but not all agencies were trained to do CPR over the phone. It was passed, and all because Angela was there to tell her story. I was there with her to tell the other side of the story, and it's passed. Now, all dispatchers, at least in my state, are required by this law or whatever you want to call it, that they have to be certified in tele-CPR. One person. One person.
Whoa, what a story. What a wonderful. I don't care how long that was. That was worth it. Thank you.
I have her picture back here behind me on a shelf right outside my bedroom door so that every time I'm going into my room or whatever, I can see her picture. I have a card that she wrote me that I put in the frame that has the words that, the thank you that she wrote me. It's all right there. I keep it as a constant reminder of what it is that I do every day at work.
Well, that's wonderful. So, how on earth do you decompress after a shift? I mean, my God, you either are Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, that you're in the workplace handling all this incredible stress, then it's time for you to stop. Well, how do you do that?
I Okay, I'm well known for breaking all of municipal laws with regards to noise and my car stereo. I listen to really super loud music on the way home. I am an 80s girl. I mean, I graduated in 1987, but I listen to really, really loud music, not just 80s hairband music, but I listen to music from all over the world. And India and Pakistan, let me tell you, they have some loud music. So I groove along with all that as well. The other thing that I do to decompress is I'm a volunteer with the high school exchange student program, and I host exchange students. It is the perfect antithesis to my job because I'm volunteering with something that I believe in, which is world citizenship. Like having all these beautiful cultures living together and keeping those cultures. We can be world citizens and still keep our cultures, our language, our traditions. And they get to learn about our culture here in the United States as well through me and through all of their experiences while they're here. And I get to help them do that. Plus, I have this high schooler living in my house. I don't have kids of my own. People think I'm crazy for taking on teenagers in my house, especially teenagers from another country that I basically know nothing about. They think I'm insane. I'm like, of course I'm insane. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing it. But at the same time, it is tons of fun. Like, it's really a lot of fun to, a kid who wakes up in the morning and wants to say good morning. And it comes out in their native language because they're still half asleep. And I learn another language. I learn other words. I learn how to deal with, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. These kids at school, they are teasing this other kid. I can't take it anymore. What do I do? How do I help this kid that's being teased? To, I can't believe that Americans think that a 4-hour drive is a short drive. Well, we do.
Yeah, we do.
We do. We think a 4-hour drive is nothing to us. Nothing. And they're further amazed by how we tell distance and time. We do. Think about it, Pat. If it's under 30 miles, we're going to tell you how many miles we're driving. But if it's more than 30 miles, we'll tell you how long it takes to get there.
That's right, yeah.
And that volunteer job that I do actually helps me at my 911 job because I live in a very multicultural jurisdiction. And so learning about all these different cultures through working with these high school exchange students and whatever also helped me in how people of different cultures process emergencies as well, and how I can talk to them and get information from them. So, there's some cultures where if they're calling the police, oh boy, it's a big deal because they would typically never report it. So now I have to be very careful how I question or whatever. And I've learned all that not only through my training at work, but working with the exchange students as well. So I decompress with super loud music. I decompress by I literally on my phone, I have songs in I think 17 or 18 languages, the last I counted, because of my exchange students. So it gets
Yeah.
played really loud. Yeah.
So good for you. What a great way to maintain a balance for yourself. That's awesome.
It is. It's fun. And what's even more fun is, they come and visit me at work, right? And now all of my coworkers are talking to them and asking questions, and they get to learn. Like my coworkers are learning just because this teenager's sitting in the room with us. And I cook food from, that I've learned from all these other cultures and whatever, and I bring it in, and usually I end up taking in more food than what I'm going to eat because otherwise I'm holding my hands around it and growling like a dog to keep people from sticking their own spoons in my food. I'm like, it's mine. Yeah. I warm up two bowls and I set one to the side for people to try. And other people are like, why would you bring a teenager from another country in to hear these calls? Isn't that traumatizing to them? No. Because sometimes these kids come from cultures where our emergencies, let's say it's a really nasty police call, let's say it's a shooting.
Yeah.
Somebody gets shot. For them, maybe for some of these cultures, seeing or hearing somebody get shot is a multiple times a day occurrence. It's not traumatizing to them at all. If it's something that I don't think they need to hear, I can unplug their headset so fast their head will spin. And I cover up my microphone really quick and I'm like, you don't need to hear this. And they're like, oh, okay. So I have the ability to control what it is that they hear, what they don't hear. I play the two off of each other quite a bit because they help me both directions.
Yeah, I can see that. So, with everything we've talked about, in what ways do you think the public may misunderstand the role of dispatchers? What would you want them to know?
We're not operators. Ugh, we don't work for the phone company, and we're not secretaries. We don't just take a message and pass it along to the fire department or the police or the EMTs. It's not like a pink slip where we fill out you're out of the office. Here you go. No, we don't do that. We are highly trained police, fire, and medical personnel. We do all three of them, but we do it through a headset because we can't see anything that's going on. We're getting into the E911 where we will soon be able to take in live video or photos that are taken or something like that. But people don't realize that's not really a thing now because it takes a lot of extra storage. It takes a lot of money, to not only build the electronic storage facilities, but to maintain those records for a certain amount of time. And if a judge orders that it has to be kept beyond however many days that the delete date might be, it takes a lot. So,
Yeah.
we're not operators. Please don't call us 911 operators. We don't work for the phone company. We are dispatchers. We dispatch police, fire, and EMS based on the information that the caller is giving us, which is not always entirely accurate. So the other thing is every time somebody says, "Can I ask you a hard question about being a dispatcher?" Invariably, the question is, "Why do you ask us so many questions? Just get the cops here." Well, I'd like to get the cops there, but I need to update them as they're making their way to you. The reason I ask questions is to update the responders as they're making their way to you. And it's also to mitigate any safety circumstances that may, not only for you, but for my responders. I can also help you stabilize an injury, stop a bleed,
Yeah.
restart somebody's heart, tell the kid not to pull the stick out of their eye, try to, I can do all of those things, right? You got somebody breaking in your house. Where can you go to get away from that, you can lock yourself away from them, or the person's already made it into the room with them and is swinging a bat at them, and I'm
Yeah.
hearing all this. I can help you stay away from that person. And if nothing else, I can record exactly what I'm hearing happening. Our headsets are super, super sensitive. I can hear stuff in the background. So I ask a lot of questions because I need to. I can't see you. How else am I going to get that information? Right? I think that's the biggest thing. And the other thing that I want people to know is for love of everything, know where you are. There's the misperception out there, thanks Hollywood, that we know exactly where you are all the time because we can see you with satellites. We can't. We can pull up ATM cameras right away and see live scenes. No, we can't. We can hit a button to have your phone tell us exactly where you are. No, that's not the truth. Your phone tells us where you are, and it's always approximate. The best phones out there are the iPhones, and they're still only good within 300 feet, 360 degrees. In my 14 years of doing this, it's certainly got much more accurate, but again, it's an approximate location. So if you don't know where you are, I don't know where you are. And if your phone is showing me you're at mile marker 256, that's because that's where your phone is saying where you are, and you're not able to tell me where you are, I'm going to start help to mile marker 256. And you might be at mile marker 240, 16 miles away.
Whoa.
And now you're going to get mad at me because I sent help to the wrong place. Well, I sent help to the wrong place because I was going, but you could just couldn't tell me where you were, and your phone was giving me an approximate location. You didn't know where you are. Please don't get mad at me.
Yeah.
I was doing the best I could with the information that I was being given. So please, please always pay attention to where you are. I can't see you. You can see where you're at. I cannot. So that's where, it can get really frustrating for callers. And I want them to just understand, know where you are. If you're on a long car trip, every 5 or 6 minutes, take a look, notice a mile marker, notice a crossroad, notice the name of a business. Please don't tell me I'm at the billboard that advertises this restaurant. Thank you. Literally still don't know where you are after that comment. I've actually gotten that multiple times to, well, I'm at the stop sign next to, that great big dairy. there's a few states in the United States that are known for being dairy. If you tell me that I'm at a big dairy in my state, okay. There's one of those every 2 miles. So, like, great. Thank you. But let's say you're going down the interstate and you remember looking at mile marker 256. We'll go back to that one. And it's been about 10 minutes, but you really don't know where you are because your car rolled over 7 times. Your brain's completely scrambled. But at least you know you're on this interstate and you last remember seeing 256. The next question I'm going to ask you is how fast were you driving? And you'll say, well, the speed limit's 75. I said, no, how fast were you driving? Well, I was doing 80. Well, I can gauge how many miles you went in 10 minutes at 80 miles an hour. And now I can figure out what mile marker you're really closest to because your phone's just not showing me anything at all. It's only showing me a tower location. It's not even giving me a GPS location.
You spend a lot of time being a detective. I mean, you're putting together
Yes.
clues and pieces of
Yes.
information.
A lot of people are really surprised to learn that we're going to ask a whole bunch of information about the crime, basic information, before we help you with your injuries.
Okay.
And people are like, but my arm's broken. Well, I've already got the ambulance started, but I want to know who broke your arm. If somebody called up and said, I just got shot, other than asking where you are, because, tell, hey, this is 911. What's the address of the emergency? I just got shot. Okay, where are you? What's the address of the emergency? Get that out of them. But I've heard them say they just got shot. I get their address. My next question is who did it? Tell me the name of the person who did it. Why am I asking the name of the person who did it? They just got shot. They might die. Even as I'm talking to them, because they're by themselves, the person who shot them took off. They might die, but everything we do is recorded. And if they name their killer, it's on the recording. So literally everything I do, even the keystrokes I make on the keyboard, is recorded. I misspell something, I backspace, that's recorded. Like literally everything that is coming into my ear, everything that I'm saying, everything that I'm typing is recorded. Everything.
Yeah, well, that would make sense.
But that's intimidating to other people.
Yeah,
Everything's being
see it.
recorded while I'm doing this. Yes.
In my research for 911 dispatchers, the phrase that always came up was never seen but always heard.
Yes.
I mean, that's you guys in a nutshell.
Yes. And remember, I said at the beginning of this, I'm not used to being on video, even though whoever's listening to this can't see either one of us, but I'm seeing you and it's unnerving just a little. Yeah, we're always heard and never seen. And when people are like, oh, this firefighter saved my life, or this EMT got my heart started again, or this police officer saved me from this bad person. The dispatchers are always forgotten.
And you are the
Really?
first of the first responders. You
Right.
got them there.
Yeah. And if we're doing our job right, it's good that we're forgotten.
It's not about you. It's about facilitating the emergency.
And getting the right help to the right place in the right amount of time.
As we wind down, I'm just curious, Marlis, based on what you do and your volunteer work, and you've been doing this for 14 years, what life lessons could a 911 dispatcher give to people?
Be compassionate with everything that's going on in this world, with everything that you encounter. If you'll pardon the language, there is bad shit everywhere.
Yes.
Yeah. And if you're lucky, you never have to call 911 for anything, even if you're just helping somebody else out, right? If you're lucky, you never have to call 911. But if you see something, you should say something. That's called being compassionate. Don't walk by the homeless person who's bleeding out their face laying on the sidewalk and just say, homeless person. Why are they bleeding out of their face? Call 911. For all we know, this person had a seizure, fell down, and cracked their head open on the sidewalk. But they need medical attention. Compassion. Be compassion. Show compassion. Live compassion. It doesn't matter how bad your day is, somebody else is having a much worse day. And if you do have to call 911, may you only have to call 911 once in your life. But your one call to 911, I do tens of times a day. So in 4 hours, if it's really, really busy in 4 hours, I could take 60 to 80 phone calls, both non-emergency and 911. So your bad day, I do multiple times a day.
Yeah.
So I understand if you're cranky, you're angry, you're scared, you're terrified, you're hurt, and you calling me all kinds of names and whatever, I don't care. I get it. But if you're being uncooperative because you're having an emergency and you're fighting me the whole way, you're only delaying help for yourself. Have a little bit of compassion and help me help you. That's what I do. My job is to help you. I wouldn't do this job if I didn't want to help people. My coworkers wouldn't want to do this job if they didn't want to help people. Try to give some of that compassion back. Show that compassion to your fellow living being. I don't care if it's a tree, a cat, a human. If it's living, show compassion.
I had no idea what a 911 dispatcher did. And listening to you, the one thing that comes through this whole conversation is your compassion and the fact that you can plug in to someone's worst day and be calm and guide them to get the help that they need. I have to tell you, Marlis, I have to say just big respect for you and
Thank you.
for the 911 dispatchers. I mean, talk about a group of badass people who are on top of everything, taking care and reaching out, and people are upset and calling you names, and you guys just steady on. And that is remarkable. I just want to thank you for coming on and sharing this. This is really an eye-opener. Thank you
And
so much.
you're very welcome. And this was just the tip of the iceberg. I'm going to encourage everybody that's listened to you, call your local 911 center. And I want you to ask if they have a policy for allowing the public to come in and do what we call sit-alongs or ride-alongs. Even our police, fire, and EMS folks that are new to the job, part of their training is they have to come up and sit with us so that they hear the other side of the radio. The responders themselves are often unaware of how much we don't give to them because we're able to resolve the issue for the
Yeah.
caller themselves. Do a ride along or sit along, whatever they may call it, because it will definitely be absolutely
Yes.
eye-opening.
Marlis, thank you so much for coming on today. This was awesome.
Thank you, and you're welcome.
And listeners, I don't know about you, but that was an earful today. And thank you for joining us, and see you next time. Thank you. Bye.